Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Here's a cool fact. A crocodile can't stick out its tongue. Another cool fact, you can get short-term health insurance for a month or just under a year in some states. UnitedHealthcare short-term insurance plans are designed for people who are between jobs, coming off their parents' plan, or turning a side hustle into a full-time gig. Underwritten by Golden Rule Insurance Company, they offer flexible, budget-friendly coverage with access to a nationwide network of doctors and hospitals. Get more cool facts about UnitedHealthcare short-term plans at uh1.com.
Go on, Phil.
You've done it again. Hello, and welcome to the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take JB or the game too seriously. I am Phil, here in the rugby dungeon, alongside JB, who's wearing shoes.
Double sheathed, actually.
double bagging tonight.
Yeah, because those shoe perverts who have been polluting our feed. Filthy, disgusting shoe perverts. Foot perverts, they're not shoe perverts, are they?
It's different. They'll be disappointed you're wearing shoes.
Yeah, because if they were shoe perverts, I've fallen right into that trap.
They're playing 4D chess with your feet. And Tim Cocker. Hello, Tim.
Hello, Phil.
Tim, your hair is looking incredible, immaculate.
The 24 hours, what a difference it can make. Although I did take your advice, Phil, and not go really early to get my hair cut. Because I took on board what you said about them being a bit rusty. Because I know when I go back to work, quite often, after a 2-week holiday, remember them? I sort of go, how do I do this again?
Yeah.
And I have to contact IT to get my password sorted.
Oh, I thought you meant like present the radio.
Yeah, no, that is what I meant.
I'm Tim.
No, genuinely, genuinely, I forget which buttons do what. After 2 weeks, so after 3 months of not cutting hair.
Yeah.
To be fair, I've got only 8 buttons on my mixer, and I have no idea what 7 of them do.
Right, so this podcast is our little monthly Q&A extra as we delve into some of the questions, thoughts, starting points, debates, and funny stories that you've been sharing with us on email and on DMs and stuff. We're contactedchasers@gmail.com. And, this is probably a good moment to say that we're on Patreon. And when we can, and it's great to see people drink out on the street just in the middle of Chorlton as I walk round to yours, JB. All the people on the street having beers, laughing and joking. It's great to see.
I'm going on the tear on Friday, decided.
Really?
Yeah, big time. Big time.
Unleashed. Is this a birthday unleash?
I'm just going to go out.
Out.
I've decided. I've seen Manchester City Centre around the Northern Quarter. It looks amazing. They've sort of pedestrianised the streets and put tables out and all sorts. So, yeah, I'm looking forward to that.
Yeah.
Well, I'm down in London Thursday, Friday this week.
How are you?
And I might try and have a drink or two in Soho.
I'm in Newcastle on Saturday. I might go on Friday night just to...
For some ruggers.
So,
nice.
We'll get into that at the end of the podcast, obviously. But no, we're on Patreon. And when we can do live shows again, we want to do lots of those tier 2 tours, live shows with actual people with expertise taking care of all the bits that really matter.
That's right.
So that we don't have an embolism or stress. And your support on Patreon is really helping with that. And in doing so, you will get priority access to live tickets when we can do them again. And among the various other things you can find, little perks you get, which you can find out about at patreon.com/eggchasers, we also have a shirt draw, which we will do in a little bit as well. But to the emails and the questions, anyone want to kick off with one?
I'd just like to point out that you're not watching the... I've named the feed the bloody European Cup feed. What an idiot. Idiot.
I'm sure you can change that.
Yeah.
Afterwards.
Yeah. Literally, as we've been talking, someone has just dropped into our DMs, our email account, and left us a message. So shall we read that?
Yeah, go on.
If I can find it. Great podcasting. James Davis. Look at that.
Hello,
hi,
James.
JD.
JD, yep, JD. Okay, not related to the European Cup, but where does the position first 5/8 come from? I can't work out how that relates to fly half. We would call it position. Right. I don't know the answer to this. This is one of the things I have had it explained to me by multiple New Zealanders, but I honestly don't know. Do you know?
I know it's an Antipodean thing, but I don't know exactly. I'm probably the same as you. I'm sure we've had it explained to us before, but I can't quite remember. First 5/8 and second 5/8, isn't
yes.
there?
Yes.
I don't know where the...
Second 5/8 is 12, isn't it?
So yeah. You've got half-backs, which is a fractional position, like... thing.
Oh,
you've got three quarters, which is what the back line is known as. So I'm assuming all these fractional descriptions of positions actually all link up in some way.
The three quarters.
So a half back would be a number nine. Nine and ten.
Hang on a minute. I thought he was a half back because he was not a back and he was not a forward. He's in between the two. Hence he's a half back.
Yeah, I know, but all I'm saying is you've got the 5/8, you've got three quarters, you've got half backs. These fractional things, do they relate to each other at all?
Well then if a half represented in eighths would be 4/8, which would mean one out from 4/8 would be 5/8. So at least that kind there is a degree of logic between those two things.
And is first 5/8 and second 5/8, or is that rugby league?
I'm not even sure.
Well, I think that's a comprehensive answer. Do you think that's a comprehensive answer?
Well, I think actually what all we've done is say, please tell us what the answer to that one is, because we don't know.
Brilliant.
And I should know. That's the sort of thing I can't believe I don't know. I think you're right. I think exactly as you said, JB, I've probably been told at some point, and it's gone in one ear, out the other.
Well, I've got a question here. Another simple one. And this is from Ben Askham, for our resident financial advisor.
Oh,
which
you.
Is JB.
Okay.
And he says, would the cost of a hair transplant be tax deductible from the income of your image rights company? And is this why we see so many players going for it?
Well, the answer is no. No, it would not. There are actually some... I'm not an accountant. This is not in any way advice. Please do not sue me. It's not what I do. I do pensions and investments, some insurance, but I do not do tax advice. However... there are some weird HMRC rules, and I'm pretty sure the example given is of an Elvis impersonator. Have you heard that one?
Yeah. So it used to be, and even in my line of work, even in radio, people used to rinse this years ago. They used to get their clothes and make them tax deductible and stuff. But now it has to be you have to demonstrate that you do not use anything for personal use. So same goes with a haircut. You used to be able to put haircuts through on... as a tax deductible expense. If you're doing a specific hairstyle for one specific shoot, let's say, then that might be able to get that one. But generally, you have the same.
What if your makeup lady does hair for BT Sports, say?
Because that would be a specific shoot, wouldn't it?
That would be specific, but then you would benefit from that haircut
afterwards.
Yeah. So I don't think haircuts you can, and clothes you definitely can't if you wear them at any point outside. So you would have to prove it's a costume, it's a specific thing.
Indeed.
Which is why, like, ZZ Top, this is a true story. So Billy Gibbons, or one of the Gibbons brothers from ZZ Top, had this really expensive sports car, which he... put in one of the music videos.
Brilliant.
To get it in as a tax deductible expense.
Awesome. So to answer the question then, unless Stuart Hogg, for example, is having his hair unplugged and then replugged around match days,
yep.
7 hours on the operating table before and after a game, then it cannot be a tax deductible.
Sounds ridiculous,
expense.
But I'm pretty sure Gavin Henson might have got some tax deductible expenses because he treated playing rugby like a night out. And actually, it was for a specific performance.
Yes, so his ladies' razors for his legs.
Yep.
His tanning creams. And
I mean, that literally was for one event. I think he probably could get away with that. I'm not so sure.
And on the broader point, I guess, he did mention it was for the image rights deal, but rugby players are employees, aren't they? So they don't have any private tax and all
you
of
can,
that.
Well, you can claim some things back.
Well, Voonprop Limited and Wiggy 9 Limited.
Which are all specifically for the image rights deals, as we covered on a previous pod.
I bet boot shopping could be fun. To a certain degree, but then even that gets old when you've got unlimited budget to buy rugby boots and people send you them for free anyway.
Yeah, I was going to say all the best players,
actually,
the top-level players, will not pay for any boots.
But then you would have to, technically, you would have to declare that as a benefit in kind.
Yes.
Not if you bought your own.
No, no.
Yeah, but if you get it as a
gift. If you get them as a gift, technically you should pay tax on that as a benefit.
Well, here's what I think. I think this question has come to its natural conclusion. That's what I think.
Agreed. I've got one from Ethan John Bamfield. Thank you very much, Ethan, who's emailed contactegchasers@gmail.com. And we've just seen French teams absolutely dominate in the Champions Cup. And he's rightly, I think, interested in that future tussle between Untermack and Jalibert. And so to sort of summarise the question, it's who do you think is the 1A and 1B in that pair when you look in the years ahead? And would you consider playing one at either 12 or 15 for France to accommodate them both?
Right. Okay, so I think he wants this in two ways. I think you say that under this coach, Untermack is the number one.
Yeah.
And I think the reason he's number one is not because he's necessarily the best fly half, but because the coach obviously likes him. He's a 12. He was a 12 at Toulouse. Now, he has been moving around a bit, little bit more. But the fact they like him so much to move him to 10 tells me that he is really very much like that. Now, long term, with a different coach, I think Jalibert probably goes up the pecking order and maybe Entomac goes out to 12. But remember this, the French do not like distributing 12, say like big Jonathan Dantes and...
Gael Ficou is a good example.
Matthew Bastereau.
Yeah, although he played 13.
He played 13.
Oh yeah, you're right.
Fofana played a lot of 12, but he's not really distributing 12, he's a running 12.
Yeah.
So yeah, the point that you made a while ago, was it from your interview with Kayser?
Yeah.
Bonjour,
I can't tell you how angry I was about that Benjamin Kayser interview, because I had an independent thought to interview Benjamin Kayser. I thought, I'm going to interview Benjamin Kayser. He's such an interesting guy. He always comes across well on TV. Unfortunately, he comes across too well. And therefore, everyone had the same independent thought as me and got all of their interviews out two days before Rugby Dungeon. Furious.
He's awesome, Kayser.
He's bloody good, isn't he?
He's really, really... And he's one of those who can... Unlike some pundits who are quite one-eyed when they're watching a team that they've played for or national team that they support, he gets across his patriotism, but also puts it across in a balanced way.
Mm.
He's superb.
Yeah, and I could listen to him just pronounce names all day. The way he was going, oh, it's a wonderful play from Faf de Clerc. It was wonderful.
You got a question there, Tim?
I've just given you one.
So I've got a question.
Go on.
So...
make sure you delete them as you read them.
This is a very interesting one. So, hello Egg Chasers. This is from Tom Riley.
Hello, Tom.
I'm a relatively new listener to your podcast, which I very much enjoy. I first need to thank you for making me seem incredibly smart in my economics course, thanks to your episode on the simultaneous multi-round auction. Because I'm a shit student and I learn half my economic theory off you, I could not name any Nobel Prize winning theory before that. Unfortunately, Egg Chaser's Rugby Podcast is not deemed a reputable source by the University of Oslo. So could you please write a quick economics paper? And that would be helpful.
Funny enough, hang on, let me get this right. Because our listener base is so knowledgeable...
It's incredible, isn't it?
Yeah.
It never ceases to amaze.
I've now got, I'd say, quite a good friend. I've never met the guy, but I text him quite a lot, who lives in Singapore, who is a very, very high-ranking economist, I guess you'd call him, who works for an investment house out in Singapore. I can't mention his name because he doesn't want me to, or who he works for, but a very big firm. And it's fascinating because I love talking about economics and I love the responses that I get about economics.
Yeah, and that was a particularly interesting potential. No word on it being taken up just yet.
But not yet.
Could enhance, not just rugby, a lot of sporting events.
Well, let's hope rugby first.
Anyway, the question. My question to you is, instead of multiple resets and penalties at scrums when they're 5 metres out, couldn't rugby employ an NFL-style half the distance to the goal, ideally? This would mean the first scrum 5 metres out would be on the five, then it'd be 2.5.
Oh, good.
And you'd move closer and closer.
That is good. That's really good.
Ooh, that's interesting. Because you couldn't do a half the distance to the goal line from halfway is significant. You take just outside the 22.
Yeah, you could maybe enforce this rule in the 22.
Within the 22. I like that.
Yeah.
What about this rule? You get to choose whether you want in the middle of the pitch or less distance.
Oh, okay.
So you can go one way or another.
Because actually I'm just thinking, certainly with pick and goes, being too close is detrimental. That's why the 5 metre line. Because for a pick and go, you've actually got to tap the ball. When you tap it, the opposition can start moving.
Yes.
They would actually nail you behind the gain line if you were half a metre from the try line. So that's no good. Scrums adds an additional layer of complexity. But there becomes no offside line from the back foot of a scrum if you're too close.
So this is a really elegant solution to a problem we don't have. Because the problem is not the penalty and the resets and the scrum. The problem is, where does the blame lie for the scrums collapsing?
That's always the problem.
Now, if you can nail where the problem lies, then you can penalise them. And actually, the set of rules we have are okay. But it's very hard, because you could have one person doing something naughty on one side and his opposite man, the other tight head on the other side, doing exactly the same naughty thing.
Yeah.
And then who do you penalise? And that's when it becomes a complete... And also, you can have a prop hinging. So it looks like the opposition prop has gone down, but actually just there's so many different things.
It looks like the opposition prop has gone long when one prop hinges.
If you could just hit a button now and go back to pre-TMO replays and TMO interventions, would you?
That's interesting. This is a little bit like the question for the people who were protesting against the M25 40 or 50 years ago, would you now go and remove the M25? And the answer is no, absolutely not. I don't think I would remove TMO interventions. I think on the whole, they do a very good job. Mm. And you only need to look at VAR to realise how good they are.
Yeah, the comparison from VAR to... I wouldn't. And for all the things that are done badly, I think the standard of refereeing and overall decision making has improved significantly, actually, even over the last 10 or 15 years.
Yeah, I completely agree, but sometimes it was sort of with the penalising at the scrums, it suddenly got made me think there is nothing perfect, but asking that question in that way just sort of might move the conversation on from just moaning about decisions.
Yeah,
because with something as complex as a scrum, that's one of the beauties of it. There will always be a slight bit of magic eight ball about it.
Yes.
Yeah, and that is the frustration. I'd almost say no penalties from scrums.
Yeah,
you can have free kicks, but almost never a penalty, because exactly as you say, Jay, you look from a different angle on the same scrum and you could penalise either team, and it's a coin toss.
You say no penalties, though, because I really like some of the strategies employed to get a penalty from a scrum. I'll give you one which I think is completely legitimate. I wouldn't like to see that thrown out just because we've said no penalties. So when the ball gets to the base of the scrum, they wait for the... I need to get this exactly right. Yeah. So when the ball gets to the 8 feet, that's when you put the secondary drive on, because the opposition flankers
will start to relax.
Yeah, start to relax because they're waiting to go for the eight, and that's when you win your penalties. And I think that's a completely legitimate bit of gamesmanship between the two packs there, and I wouldn't like to see that go.
Well, maybe there is a threshold of clear and obvious, and when one team is just marching forward, I would always want that to be part of the game, because, you know, those days of watching Tonga Weir and Majati at Northampton just...
Well, La Rochelle this weekend.
Let's
talk about that.
Yeah. Or Leicester Tigers against Newcastle.
Yeah, so maybe it's a bit too hasty to say no penalties, but it's the lottery element of it.
The ones that append immediately on the hit when one hinges from the hip and one goes flat onto the floor, and sometimes it's given one way, sometimes it's given the other.
So I know I've spoken about this before, but there is a really interesting bit of work done by, I want to say Dassault, but it's not Dassault, it's a different French aviation firm who built the scrummage machine for France, and they'd hit this machine, and what they found is they were hitting so hard, they were bouncing out of their binds. This is when you did have a hit, and now they sort of engage. And it does seem like that solved a lot of problems. But, yeah.
Well, that's another one, is that you just made me think. Is there any new contraptions that rugby could use to solve current issues? Because I remember seeing that little video of the Curry twins.
You've been on the Rhino.
Doing their jacqueline with the Rhino tackle bag things. Not tackle bag, but the...
Yeah,
what's it called?
They've got all sorts.
Of those big round stand-up things on the floor, and then you've got people pulling them in different directions. Well, with rubber bands.
Yeah, diamond with two rubber bands for BT Sport, holding them like they're Alsatians or like little fighting bulldog type things.
Sicken.
yeah. Well, go on the Rhino website. They make things on there, contraptions which I didn't even think that I needed, but they big donuts, which you strap a ball into and you roll across the pitch, and then someone's got to take the ball up the donut. There's all sorts of weird stuff.
A lot of coaches have come up with inventive things that they've adapted, things which already exist. Like Steve Borthwick gets up on a stepladder for lineouts. He stands on a stepladder and puts his arms up in the air, and the hookers have to try and hit his hands. And then you've got, I think it might be Northampton, I can't remember which team, but they have like a big like landing fishing net, which the coach holds up in the air and the hookers throw it in the net.
So here was my idea.
And that goes up, they'll put it to a different height and they've got to hit it, haven't they?
Yeah.
So here was my idea, and if you want to make this, you can, but you need to pay me royalties. So do you know, in the gym, you get your 20-kilogram bar.
Yeah, me and Phil know about the gym.
Yeah, of course. You put it in the corner, and then you do your lifts or your rows on it.
Yeah, I know what you mean.
Yeah.
So you do like a chest press type thing with it pivoting in the corner, or you'll do a barbell row to the chest.
Yes, barbell row would be the best way to describe it. So it was kind of like that, but then a fixture on the floor, which releases with a certain amount of pressure. So you can either go on it and then lift the bar, and it releases a certain amount of pressure when you're pulling up. Or, better still, you have different rugby balls, which with a hole in, which you put on the bar, right? And they're different weights. So it replicates a weighted jackal.
So it's like you're trying to lift the ball, the weight of a man. So you could put 120 kg, so you're lifting a prop, but your grip point is the ball.
Correct.
Ah.
Yes. And then you can just do your rows, but with like a rugby ball.
Yeah.
And you could hold it in different directions and all sorts.
Now, you can always do that just with a partner, but you can't do it on your own in the gym.
You can't, no.
And
you
need, if you want to range from, say, a warm-up weight of 60 kg through to a 154 kg Uini Antonio, you'd have to have 20 partners.
Yeah, do you know, you've just given me an idea there. So my idea was actually a actual weight in the shape of a rugby ball. Like kettlebells are all the same size, but different weights.
Yeah, yeah.
But actually, if I just had the grip, I could use traditional weights and put the grip on the end and then jackal that.
Having weighted rugby balls from, a regular weight rugby ball through to Uini Antonio, where it's made of plutonium or something
but where they look exactly the same. So when you throw one at someone, they're expecting a normal rugby ball. Yeah. That would be quite funny.
Have you ever thrown a pass developer at someone to kick? Hilarious. Absolute banter. Yeah, it's like, follow this. And they, it's highly amusing. Of course, many podcasters have not played rugby, so they wouldn't know. Next question.
Oh, no, I was also just going to ask one more little hypothetical question. If you could have it so that, like ice hockey, punch-ups one-on-one were allowed, would you let that go? Maybe.
No.
Yeah.
I'm afraid to say. I mean, I'd want to say yes for the machismo, but actually, the answer's no.
I also wouldn't, albeit I'd like to see it. I'd like to see how brave people actually are if that was the rule. Because now there's, people are very brave when everyone knows that they are not going to get punched.
Yeah.
So everyone can stand up to anyone.
And for the record, in ice hockey, they still get the equivalent of yellow cards.
Yeah. I don't want to institutionalise it, although I wouldn't mind a blind eye being turned to it. Let's put it that way. But I don't want it to be a thing which, like, I don't want there to be a player on there just to fight. Because you do have that in amateur rugby, a guy who's just come on there just to fight. And it's not particularly pleasant, but it does occasionally happen.
Yeah.
So, no, I wouldn't want that to be a thing.
Yes, I actually agree, but that doesn't mean I don't miss a proper scrap.
Yeah,
if they want to get I don't miss some genuine shoe pie.
Yeah, if it's boiled over, genuinely boiled over, by all means. Yeah. I saw a wonderful video the other day of a second row in training knocking out one of his teammates. Who was that? London Scottish, maybe. Don't know. It was making the rounds on...
I know the video you're talking about. No, it was London Irish.
It
was London Irish.
Someone gets absolutely leathered.
I know the players you're talking about.
Do you?
I do know the players you're talking about, yeah.
I wonder if I can find that video again one day. Okay, I'm going to go with this question, and this is from Dave. I want to say Kuzik. And he was listening to the podcast. He has a few thoughts. He wants to defend sociologists, which is brave. It wouldn't be the hill I chose to die on, but okay. Noted, you want to defend sociologists. He does agree with a lot of what we say about, you know, the fake expert bollocks, and that there is a lot of fake expertise when it comes to the concussion, high tackle, safety debate. But he has this question. With that in mind, what do you think a study into concussion in rugby should look like? What sort of questions should be asked? And who should be consulted? What sort of statistical data should be examined? Over to you, gents.
Great question.
It is a really good question.
Because it's all well and good us kind of observing that, much like a tobacco company funding research into cigarettes, people with an agenda researching concussion will always come to one conclusion.
Yeah. And to be clear, on the, because he's referring to my comment about sociologists tend not to use empirical data, as in large numbers, large sample sizes and stuff. That is very often true, and they use ethnography, is what it's called.
What?
It's basically they use individual cases and draw those together to create themes, and that's called an ethnography, I think.
I have seen a sociologist talk about rugby.
So all I was saying is, of course they do. But very unempirically, I was taught. Yeah. I made an absolute statement about something which is not absolute.
Yeah. So just I have actually seen a sociologist talking about rugby, and he describes rugby as child abuse. Child abuse through neglect. And I would think neglect would be not taking your child to rugby and instead locking him up in a flat.
That is what's really hard about this, because I don't want to get into COVID as a thing, but it's similar in the sense that, yes, people get ill and die from COVID-19.
What about all the other damage?
But it's about the cost and the consequences of the way that you choose to deal with that, and what might the ramifications be both now and in the longer term, economically, socially, in terms of health. And actually, you can't decide whether the actions that were taken are right and proportionate unless you actually factor all of those things in. And that's what's difficult with concussion is, you know, self-esteem, confidence, socialisation, leadership, tolerance, respect.
Discipline.
Discipline, health, fitness. All of these things are factors as well.
So let's think of the actual questions here, okay?
Yeah.
So with this in mind, what do you think the study into concussion should look like? So I'll start off with that one. The study into concussion should be limited in its focus to only the professional game. I think you need a scientific answer where science is responsible for an increase in concussions. And I think that is pretty obvious that when you get superhumans running into each other with the added advantage of sports science and training and nutrition, more concussions will happen. And it is a professional sport, and it is revenue generating. That's what I would say it needs to look at. I think it leaves the amateur game completely alone. What sort of questions should be asked? I honestly don't know. And what sort of statistical data should be examined? I have no idea.
Yeah. I'm less averse to studying the amateur game as well. I think the main focus should be on the professional game. And I think World Rugby do a lot of this. Certainly over the last few years, they've hugely increased this element. But it should be some of the data that we've already had that has led to the law variations, or rather the guidance on the high tackle framework and the head contact framework has come out of data from World Rugby, which showed, for example, the counterintuitive thing that the tackler is more likely to be concussed from a tackle than the tackled player.
Yes.
Which is, without the study into it, we wouldn't have had that bit of data. And because it's if you think of a concussion from a tackle, the immediate thing you will think of is high tackles, where the ball carriers have their head taken off, which of course does lead to a high tackle. That's an extreme example, but immediately obvious. But far more innocuous, but far more frequent, is bad tackle technique from a tackler two players go high, or just one player goes low, one player goes high, and a head hits an elbow, a shoulder, a hip, a knee.
Just think of this. So here's a question I'd like to ask, and it's not really about concussion, but I think it's a really important thing we have to get established, which is what... I don't know how you even go about doing this, but I think we need to sort of establish what the perceived risk of rugby is before publishing what the actual risk of rugby is. Now, the reason I say that's important is because I don't perceive it as very dangerous. And if it was told to me it was 20 times more dangerous, I think I would still play. But I don't know...
But your baseline would be very different to...
Yes.
Alison Pollock's, for example.
Exactly. What is our baseline of risk?
Yeah.
So Alison Pollock would say, it's very risky. There's lots of parents out there who say, it's very risky. So I'd like to know what the how it is perceived before we go and then say, well, here's some data. Because I don't know if that data would say... I mean, if you told me... Hang on. If you told me it's very risky, I'd agree with you, but I'm happy to accept that risk. That's what I mean. How much risk are people are willing to accept?
And so, once upon a time, when motor cars were first, when they were new, and I think motor cars are responsible for the most amount of deaths, and if you put deaths and injury together, probably the highest cause of total risk in adults in the UK.
Doesn't surprise me.
Possibly in the world. And one... There was a time when the speed limit for motor cars was 2 miles per hour. And there was even a period where if you had a motor car, you had to have someone going in front of it, waving a flag. So now you could cut all death and all personal injury from motor vehicles by reverting to a 2 miles per hour speed limit.
Yeah.
But the reason we don't is because in order to function in the way we want and to have the kind of lives we want, we all accept... a level of risk that means we may well die and we may well get injured.
But it's worth it to get our shopping.
But it's worth it to live the way we want to do. Yeah. And so
worth just, it to go to hospital, worth it to do all
so,
these things.
So to tap into what you're saying, I think that there is a general safetyism across culture at the minute. And I just think accepting risk... is absolutely essential. And so I think that any research that's done needs to be done very long term, and because there's various things they haven't even broken down. Everything's focused on what happens in games, but we're starting to hear stuff about the repeated small impacts in training, and they can actually be far more consequential than one huge hit on a match day.
And I think the pro game does have some real issues because they are training every day. They do have multiple impacts, far more than I have, far more than any amateur player has. And the thing which really muddies it is the money. Because you're paying them, they're incentivized to stay in the game even against their own benefit, their own health benefit. Whereas if I'm really badly concussed, I'll stop playing. I'll just stop playing tomorrow. I mean, I probably wouldn't. But that's my personal choice,
That's your personal choice.
A lot of people would.
Yeah.
But if your mortgage... If your mortgage depends on it, then it's a much more difficult decision.
Yeah, so we owe it to the pros to actually look into this to the nth degree. We owe it to them to explain exactly what the risks are, but I don't think we change the game fundamentally unless you've got a really compelling thing to tell me.
Yeah.
Because we've outlined the risks, here they are, would you still like to play? Yes, I would. Okay.
And I think one thing you can acknowledge is that, in professional rugby, body types have changed. People are bigger than they have been in other ages and stuff, but it's a very different... Amateur versus professional is two completely different sports, effectively. But when you look at laws and stuff, rather than being punitive and just constantly trying to stop that, do that, make sure you only do that to I would try and be more proactive, and things like trial, no knock-ons.
That is to get
more ball in play time, less scrums, change the body type of players.
But scrums are no longer the problem. The reason we came up with no knock-on is because that was the moral panic of the day a few years ago. The scrums were going to end the sport.
No, but I have said before, you tell me, and if you're listening, keep your eyes out on it and tell me the next time you see it, because I'm going to maintain you will not see this statistic on the telly. Ball in play time does not get shown, because it would be an embarrassment to rugby if it was ever shown, because... Ball in play time, typically in games, is about 25 to 30 minutes.
Yeah, you're right. We need to really reduce that. Okay, so we have another question, unless you have one. I have one here, and I love this question.
Go on, you go for that one.
Okay, this is from Edmund Smith. Hello, Edmund.
Hello.
Hi, guys. Love the show, obviously. What do you think of having maximum combined weights for the squad so you can have your massive wingers, but you have to compromise in the centres or the pack? This would stop the trend towards every position getting bigger. Love it, love it, love it, love it, love it. No. This is like one of those all-time questions.
This would be 0% body fat. This would be rugby's not a game for all ages anymore, all size, shapes and sizes anymore.
I never thought of that.
And stripping and shredding before the fight.
God, the drugs problems having would be to massive.
Make, yeah.
No, genuinely, they would,
wouldn't they? Things like having to make weight before the game.
Oh, wow. Yeah, I never thought of that. You'd have to have a playing weight where you'd be comfortable at, because, I guess fighters do. Okay, you couldn't be a fighter, could you? Because a fighter just has to strip all his weight.
He has one. 24 hours before a fight, he has to be a certain weight. He or she has to be a certain weight, and then that's it. And you fight once every 3 months.
Yeah, but there are wrestlers, I think, will do more weekends, like collegiate wrestlers. So they all be stripped. Oh my God, what an awful profession this would be. Because you have to strip your weight during the week and then get back up. You weigh in on a Friday before the game or Thursday, and then drink loads of Coke and eat pizzas and whatnot, get back up to weight like fighters do, and then away you go. Oh, that sounds horrendous.
Yeah, and the additional strain on your body if you're trying to recover while you're training, recover from the game, recover while you're training, but also manage your weight to that point. It could be the unintended consequences in terms of player well-being could be massive.
No, but on the flip side, like Faf de Klerk would be the most valuable player on earth.
Yeah,
Aaron Smith.
You would never see a Mike Phillips scrum half again.
Yeah.
Like, no, I can't accommodate someone as big as you.
Scrum halves are like jockeys.
Yeah.
But someone like Cheslin Colby would be incredible.
So,
or Mike Lowry.
Right, okay. So I love the concept. I think the concept's bloody brilliant.
The strategy element they would add to the game would be huge. I don't think it's worth it for that. I think the trade-offs in other areas are, it's too big.
Yeah, I've never considered that. I've just thought, yeah, okay, we'll just assemble a bunch of boys.
A lot of Fijians would, not just because they're huge men, but because you wouldn't take the risk if you were a club going, well, when he goes back home for 3 months, who knows what he's going to be like when he comes back?
Well, hang on. Is this... this probably sounds like a question for Ross Tucker, someone like that rather than me. Well, definitely, actually. Is there a way to get strong without increasing your muscle size? Like, is there a type of strength that you can... Like, can you be powerful without having, big muscles?
You can get stronger. So fighters will train to get stronger without necessarily getting heavier, except in heavyweight categories.
Because obviously absolute strength relies on muscle size.
Like one rep max and that's done. That's totally anaerobic. That doesn't engage your aerobic system at all to just have max strength.
But then...
But you can definitely get stronger without necessarily getting heavier. Yeah. There would be a compromised relationship between the two. So if you want to be absolutely stronger, look at Eddie Hall sitting at 190-something kg when he's competing in the World's Strongest Man.
Yeah.
And he can drop down to 150 or 160 kg, but he will not be as strong.
So I've had fights with unbelievably strong individuals who are tiny in jiu-jitsu. Unbelievably, it's like trying to bend iron bars. You just can't do anything with them, like alien face huggers.
Well, that's also like where the strength is as well. That will be total core.
And coordination
core,
of it.
Yeah,
wonder if it changes how these guys train, and also is there an element of what they do in training to put on muscle bulk for protection from injury or whatnot?
Yeah,
I don't know.
And isn't jiu-jitsu isn't a big part of that, using your opponent's weight and force?
I think Steven Seagal says about Aikido, but I think actually it's just about...
No, oh my God, I interviewed Steven Seagal once. And
didn't he need to break your wrist?
And I just said to him, look, I just want to feel what it's like to be on the receiving end of something. Can you just do some Aikido on me? And he said, hold your arm out. He just said, come at me. So I just did a very slow motion punch. And he just, with no effort whatsoever, as soon as he grabbed my wrist, it was like a bear. Ooh. It was unbelievable. And he just
is he a big guy?
He's massive.
Is he?
He's huge. And he just put my arm in a position, and I couldn't move. And it felt like my forearm bone was bowing.
Wow.
Yeah. It was frightening.
So I really like Under Siege. I love it because of the Missouri class. Is it Missouri class battleship? I'm going to be embarrassed if it's not. I'm sure it's the USS Missouri. Wonderful ship.
Steven Seagal is, according to this, 6'3", 6'4", and 120 kilos.
I'd fancy my chances.
That's tight end prop territory.
His hands were massive.
So are mine.
you're under 100 kilos at the moment.
Yeah, but I'm, look.
It's what you do with it.
Yeah, if I bulk like Steven Seagal, I'm pretty sure I'd take him.
Just to answer the flip side of that
don't
question.
Don't rock on JB's antique chairs.
Don't rock on the chairs, Phil.
Sorry.
Jesus Christ.
The flip side of that question, which I do remember Ross Tucker talking about on his Science of Sport podcast, is kind of the reverse of it is when you are an endurance athlete, lower weight is always better.
Yes.
So there is the more you lose, the better you're doing up to a point, because the trend for that would be, well, if you weigh 0 kilograms, you're going to be the best performing you can possibly be. And that is not true. There will always be a tipping point past which you, the more weight you lose, you'll have compromises in strength. And
yes,
like, the reverse will be true. There'll be a relationship that you can get stronger at the same weight. You could get stronger again if you put on weight, but there'll be like a balancing point, a tipping point between the two.
Gavin Hegarty has emailed, and this is off the back of, inspired by something that happened in the Leinster game the other day. And he said, "Hey lads, something we've been talking about on WhatsApp just came up again. Leinster got advantage under the posts, and then Jordan Lama scored a try in the corner. Would it make sense for the conversion to be given from where the advantage was given?" It's an interesting thought from Gav, John Cummins and Connor Cronin.
I think that's a good rule. I don't think...
No, because the trade-off is you take the three. If you've got a kick in the middle, you can take the three, or you can roll the dice to score out wide, and then if you fail to score out wide, you can come back and take the three. So it seems like too much of a... It seems like too much of a benefit to roll the dice, manage to get, and then still get the original conversion.
Yeah, I think that's
fair. And what happens if you get the advantage in a less... No, hang on. Does it matter? Does it? Is it advantage?
Yeah. Well, here is what...
Your advantage.
So I think we're saying, no, we're all right with it as it is, Gavin. But it sparked one thought of mine is with one of those strange occurrences, which we've seen a few times recently. There was a couple of times in the Six Nations where... a penalty try was scored and a yellow card was given, but on the occasions when a player actually scores, the yellow card is not given.
Yeah.
Even when if it was like advantage, I'm going to give a penalty try, but the player then scores, oh, I'll give the score no yellow card versus yellow card.
And in that scenario, because the penalty try is automatically 7 points, and I think in one of those scenarios they scored right in the corner. So this is one where there was definitely one in the Six Nations, I can't remember which game, where they would have been better to not play the advantage, allow it to be penalty try.
No yellow card and potentially no conversion.
Yeah, and it ended up being a 5 point score and no yellow card instead of a 7 point score and a yellow card.
Yeah.
So that's the one that... But then it's... I think you should still be able to come back, which I think you can still come back for the yellow card, even if play progresses significantly beyond it.
So the reason I don't think it... I think it's okay as it is because I think a penalty try is for, like, the most egregious of infringements. So they would say... Hang on. Well, it's not, is it? Because if you think the try would have been scored and the penalty is committed...
It's the probability of it.
Yeah. So then that is a penalty try. But that standard is not always enforced, I don't think. So
it's inconsistent at times.
Actually, no, because if you think about let's just look at an offside. That's probably your most commonly occurring penalty in a game of rugby in the 5 metres when you're about to score.
Yep.
So you're persistently offside. Well, if it's a penalty try for being persistently offside, I've never seen that.
No, because... You wouldn't have it's got to be the weight of probability is that it's most likely that you would have scored the try.
Yeah.
So offside would be very difficult to, unless you're offside and you intercept.
Slap it down.
Well, yeah, but then it would be the deliberate knockdown. But if you're offside and intercept, so the only penalty is the offside when there's a 2-on-1 in the corner, that could lead to an offside being a penalty try. But I don't recall ever seeing
that. Yeah, so
if
it's a penalty advantage but they score because you're offside, I think that's broadly speaking okay. The reason you'd yellow card someone and give a penalty try is because the thing you've done is so egregious that you just prevented a try, and that does deserve the yellow card. Get off.
Yeah, unless the only other one would be if it is a team warning balls. For repeatedly offside, the final offside prevents a scorable opportunity, then that could be a yellow card and a penalty try for an offside.
Excellent.
Pat, how would you say your name if it was... So, it's Patrick, and the surname is... It's either Tipsword or Tipsword. I'd go Tipsword if I had the choice.
Tipsword.
So, hopefully, you've gone Tipsword, Patrick. If not, change the way you say your name. Anyway,
Patrick T, I thought it was Patrick... what's his name? Tuipulotu. Tuipulotu, because I know he does listen.
We'll have to get him an egg chaser's tie.
Patrick T.
So Patrick is one of our American listeners. We have quite a lot of those, so thank you very much, Patrick.
Millions.
Very much appreciate your time. No, it's like I'm not no word of a lie. It's like 10 or 15% of our of our audience is American, which
is amazing. Makes sense, right? Because when I wanted to get into NFL all those years ago, before NFL was mainstream, the only way you could get any access to NFL content was by podcasts. Hence, I got into podcasts.
And so, out of a third of a billion people, there's a couple of million of them will. Yeah, into rugby.
Exactly.
Yeah. Anyway, he's just basically saying thanks for the podcast. He spent a couple of years over in the UK at school in Newcastle at the same sick form and in the same time as Toby Flood was playing there, and he played a bit of rugby there.
Wait. That isn't Newcastle. Is that Barnard Castle that Toby Flood was at?
Well, he said he spent a few years living in Newcastle during sick form.
Okay. He went to, I can't remember the name of it, but
King something school.
It doesn't matter.
King's School. Anyway, he's just said tier two tour request in for Phoenix, Arizona.
In. Absolutely.
Oh, yes.
Do they have an MLS team? MLS. MLR.
Phoenix, MLR.
I don't think they do.
Phoenix is going to be a cool town. Very cool town.
Yeah. But.
Could we do it on our Marseille road trip?
Yeah. Stop off in the Cognac region.
Yeah.
Arizona's not far from. We could do Phoenix and then hop over to the Giltinis.
Isn't it meant to be unbelievably hot in Arizona?
There's a lot of desert there, yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. Like Grand Canyon is in part of that state, isn't it?
I've got no idea.
Nevada and Arizona, Grand Canyon.
Hang on.
There's a lot of desert.
Yes, the answer is yes, we'd like to do Arizona very much.
See you there. Nice one.
No, was there a question?
No, I was just sharing that.
Okay. Here's a question. This is from Chris Andrews. Hello, Chris. Loves the pod, obviously.
Standard.
Something that's always bothered him is why do losing teams not counter on the last play of the game?
So I can tie something else in with this, which bugs me. The way that, particularly towards the end of a game, referees just allow everything to go. Like the team with the ball can just seal off and chuck eight men into a ruck with no discipline at all, and they just.
I have very rarely,
if ever, seen someone steal a ball in the last minute of a game or a penalty be given against the team in possession.
So I think you very, very rarely see someone steal a ball. I think it doesn't always happen, but sometimes referees actually sharpen up around players supporting their own body weight in the last 2 or 3 minutes. And it's when it happens, I seem to think that the commentators often reference, the directive is to sharpen up. And so you'll sometimes see penalties against the first man on the offensive side of the ruck, first man supporting, not supporting his body weight, which you would never normally see. So I definitely think the jackal, you never see a jackal.
No,
in the
and
last
why
couple
would you? Because they are so good at protecting the ball when they need to, because everyone's there.
And they slow it down. You've got a ball carrier and three men behind him all just blitz straight past. So the jackling becomes impossible, but the penalties do happen, but I think it's inconsistent.
And there are techniques you can use to counteract, but when they've thrown so many guys into the ruck, you're wasting your time. You're probably better off to get off the line, make a dominant hit, and then counter-ruck through the gate afterwards,
You've got to try and shut them down. But then even then, if you try and knock them back behind the gain line, some players will just get the ball and then just dive at divert ankles to make sure they hit the deck.
So if you are moving the ball back, say, 5 yards, and you've got a pod of three there, which is quite common, and they're intentionally going to lose the ground, they can set up a fairly effective ruck. But if you come in steaming in with a bit of momentum, I think you've got more of a chance of contesting that ruck than you have the previous one from a static position. But there are coaching techniques that you can use. I don't know if you've ever seen this, but if you're engaged into a ruck, your partner comes behind you in your team and sort of puts his thigh on to like the middle of your arse. This is an incredibly homoerotic rugby.
His thigh.
So you're engaged in the ruck as a defender, right?
Yeah.
And you want to counter ruck, and they've got lazy. It's quite a nifty technique, this. So then your mate will come behind you, right? Grab you kind of on the shoulder, and he's sort of lining up so you are. So he, you, as the initial rucker, right, have been dissected by his knee. Does that make sense?
It does. I'd love to see you manipulate Tim in this way.
It's quite hard to explain. It's very, very good at attacking a static ruck when people have switched off. Okay. But I'm going to
go to Tok H and go with a doll. Show me where JB touched you.
Don't swim on the chair.
There has been a few messages coming in on the live chat as well, actually. And I do love this one from Niall Higgins, who says, "Completely irrelevant, boys, but I thought I'd point out that whenever I'm listening to the podcast and JB speaks, I have an image of Michael Gove in my head. Don't ask me why." And I was
great
thinking,
policy.
Well, I was wondering, like, what public figure, if you try and wipe your mind that you know me or Phil, what public figure would you have in your mind if you were listening to us?
Oh, if I was listening to you.
Because I get a lot of, you don't look how I thought you would when I've been on the radio before. I got that all the time.
Well,
people go, "Oh, you're tall."
Yeah, so people, when they see us on the live stream, think that I am Phil. Well, yeah, they think Phil sounds like I would look.
Okay.
I've had that quite a lot. So they're surprised it's me talking.
So the public figure to have in your head when you're thinking of Phil is Shrek when he's human.
Yeah, okay. I don't know, really.
No, I don't know. Doesn't matter. And also, some people are saying that the sound might be a bit gainy on the... Is that on your tablet or is that...
Wait a second, I can sort that out. The reason it's gainy is because... I don't want to brag. I've just had it in a different mode because I was interviewing Dan Bigger on that same channel.
Right.
Don't like talking about it, though. I don't want to talk about it.
So, okay.
Yeah, but I interviewed Dan Bigger.
So Dan Bigger was a lot quieter than we are.
Yeah.
So fine.
So when's that going to be hitting our feeds?
Tonight. Or I might delay it. I might delay it and tease it for one more day.
Yeah. Do it another day. Give it another day because we've got people soak up this podcast.
What a guy,
and they can soak up the next podcast.
What a guy.
I've always been incredibly impressed with him.
He's amazing. Genuinely amazing. When did you get to speak to him?
Well, post-match interviews. And in fact, when Northampton, when the Premiership came back and Northampton had those terrible run of forms, Dan Bigger won a game against Worcester at Franklin's Gardens, and Dan Bigger spoke after the game, and it was just like, I actually just came away, I think on the podcast he even said, "What a bloke."
Yeah, he's cool, isn't he? He's really cool.
Yeah. I'm really looking forward to this, because I've, other than the occasional post-match interview, which, other than you, Tim, a lot of journalists rarely get much out of the players. Mm. I don't think I've heard many bigger interviews.
Exactly why I wanted to interview him.
I always hear good things about him.
Yeah, I never, honestly, I'm the same as you. Like, I didn't really know what he thought about anything. So, let's have him on the podcast. I've got...
You know what he thinks about refereeing decisions in a game sometimes?
Well, he references this. Mm. And he says the reason that he does these sort of things
is... to be revealed in 24 hours' time.
Exactly right. Exactly right.
There you go. That's
he does
done.
Actually talk about it.
That's how it's done. And Tom Wright also messages saying, "When is the theme tune for the podcast going to be played on those trumpets that he can see just out of shot?"
Ooh.
So I did make some good progress on the Washington Post March, and I've not played it for a little while. But yes, I am working on it once a week.
Mm, for the Tier 2 tour?
Almost certainly not.
That would be pressure.
I can play a few good things.
And one other one that I think this is almost like Ed on the live chat has just come up with a thing which we need to have a little think about ourselves and come up with a plan. He said, "Any insight on the Rugby World Cup 2023 live pod preparations? A concerned American asking to align with the first ever Rugby World Cup French tour. So there are people that will be in France thinking about stuff, but we need to think about our plan for next year.
Yeah.
We could buy a mobile van, because all vans are mobile.
An immobile van.
A static van, and tow it around France. We could basically do a podcast every day if there's a match on. So, yeah.
We could do that.
We should do that, actually. It should be the law.
We need to sort out, we need to think about what we're doing for tickets / accreditation / getting over there.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-? So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
Yes, so message about Wi-Fi, a message about... Oh, from James Parrott. Where's the question? If I can't see the question mark, I'm going to skip over it.
What type of training are you doing at the minute? Because I'm just thinking of like amateur clubs, because you're not actually preparing for specific games just now, are you? So
am I allowed to talk about that? What kind of training are we doing? So,
all in line with the guidelines.
No, I'm just wondering, like broadly speaking, because there's no definitive dates on returning to play in leagues, fixtures, that kind of thing.
Yeah, so we have little pools of teams who we will be pitched against for friendlies. So that is.
And is
a
this
thing.
Countrywide?
I don't know if it's countrywide, but this is the thing which we've okay. got. So, during the last lifting of lockdown, there was one weekend, the glorious 19th, as it will be known now, as of December, where we got our act together with Stockport and we played a game, and it was literally the best thing I have done in 12 months. It was comfortably the best thing. Nothing really compares to it. We've tried to rearrange another game with Stockport, but they already have all their pool games together. So, 27th of April is what I think is the date where we can play our first ready for rugby game, which is rugby without scrums and mauls.
Okay.
But like, who's gonna say, right?
We could roll the tape on old podcasts, and the you of a couple of years ago would be outraged at yourself for even entertaining this concept.
Do you know, it's bloody good, though. Having played it...
I'm not judging it. I'm just holding a mirror back to the past for you.
Look, if we could get away with it, we would get away with it. There's no two ways about it. We would just say, look, no one's going to... But it's the reason that prison officers hang around in groups of five with very influential gangster prisoners, because I think it's five is the minimum you need not to be corrupted. If you hang around in a group of five, like you caught...
It's 30... Difficult.
Good luck trying to get 30 on the same script.
Yes. Well, what would happen if,
accidentally scrimmage fell into
no,
it.
Through no fault of your own, a referee really took let the boys play to an extra degree and didn't penalise any mauling?
Yeah. I mean,
or I can rucking.
See, I can see why you think it's a go, because obviously, you know, you think the moon landings didn't happen and everyone was paid off there. So 30 people would be easy. No, by the time we paid everyone off to let us play actual rugby, we may as well wait for the extra 4 weeks to play it. But the ready for rugby...
Oh, if it's only 4 weeks...
Though. I think it's like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the ready for rugby stuff, I mean, as much as I hated the idea of it, because I thought it was opening Pandora's box for all sorts of other law changes, and it might still in the future... But it's actually really fun to play, and you can get a lot out of it. So if you want to play Didsbury Talk H, we are looking for a fixture on the 27th. I think it's 27th of April. Come play us. We are ready to play.
What an invite!
You're ready for rugby.
You're ready for rugby.
ready for rugby.
Yeah,
we got a very thought. I've forgotten the name, and I apologise. And I will find it out and mention you at some point. We got a very long and very thoughtful email from another American listener. I can't remember the woman's name. Anyway, one of our Patreon supporters, I apologise, but just asked if we've been watching any of the women's rugby?
So I've watched pretty much all the highlights. Pretty much all the highlights of the Six Nations. We mentioned this last week that the tournament, for obvious reasons, has been reduced, and it's basically funneling for a key clash of England versus France in the final weekend.
I'm going to watch that game.
Which both of them, neither team has had a particularly strong test thus far. That should be a really good game.
Yeah, I'm going to give you. I was going to lie. I'm going to give you the honest answer.
No, just be honest, mate. I haven't watched it just because there's so much rugby on.
So this is what I was originally going to say. I'm going to say, look, I don't watch Pro 14. I don't watch much else. I watch the Premiership, and that's it. I just don't have the time. But then, actually, I do like women's rugby. I used to watch a lot of it a few years ago. I just find it tiresome now. Not the sport itself, but the coverage and the belly aching. Not from the women that play, you understand, but from the people around it, which has got me to the point now, I just don't want to know. I think it's so bloody political that it's better off just scooting straight past it. If you try and follow women's rugby, like I had done for years, and you pick up an article now, the first couple of paragraphs is about, it's unequal, or it's some problem. And I'm thinking, all I want to know is a match report. Just tell me who the five best players are in the world. Tell me what the systems and processes are. Tell me about the match. Actually, all you end up getting is loads and loads of politics. So for that reason, I have just not watched women's rugby since, really. I've gone from trying to follow week in, week out, the escapades of
Waterloo.
Furswood Waterloo. So just I couldn't care less.
Well, and do you know what? And I sympathise with what you're saying there. And the reason I'm giving a totally honest answer, and it's odd that I think a lot of people do feel conscious about saying the honest truth. If some people are like me, there's only so much time I have in my week. I have a family. I have several jobs, and I try and watch as much rugby as I can, including doing podcasting and videos on YouTube and stuff. So I don't watch it. And a lot of people, I think, for the reasons you're talking about, feel like they're going to be a pariah of some kind if they just say, no, I don't watch it. I haven't watched it. I will watch England-France because I'm looking forward to that. But I'm not really interested in watching England, who are an excellent team, absolutely panning Italy or Wales.
Completely anecdotally. And I think this is a Twitter thing, not a real-life thing. But people have gone from being very welcoming to women's rugby to being absolutely polarising. And the one thing which gets me is it's sort of dependent on saying to people, you should be interested in this, you should watch it, and the emphasis is on us to watch more of it. And I'm thinking, well, I used to try and watch it, but I'm not going to bother now. Well, if you tell me what to do, I basically won't do it.
Well, what I'm taking a lot of interest... I mean, Phil's pays for... You know, the odd game to watch his beloved Canes. There's loads of free rugby. I want to see how Major League Rugby pans out, and I want to watch a bit more of that, which is being live streamed. Super Rugby
AU
is being live streamed. Also, I want to reconnect with the Championship.
Quite
a lot.
And I enjoyed watching. I paid for Saracens Ealing, the first one when Ealing beat them. Actually, I think they beat them in both games, didn't they? It was a really good game.
Yeah, and again, just from the interest that there's been and the spotlight on it from Saracens being in that league, it's just a reminder that the players are really, really good. The quality of rugby is outstanding. So I want to make a bit of an effort to reconnect there because I've got a soft spot for Nottingham. So there's a lot of things I would watch. Actually, England-France in women's rugby, I'm all over that. England-New Zealand, France-New Zealand, all over those. I'm not really interested in the games that have been so far.
Yeah, I agree with that. I'll tell you a club to watch out for. Plymouth. I was going to say Plymouth Argyle. Plymouth Argyle. That is a football club. Plymouth Albion.
Yeah.
I was speaking to someone who's involved in Plymouth Albion the other day, and I'm quite excited about what they've got going on there.
Your brother was.
He used to play there, yeah.
The crowds they used to get were ridiculous.
I know, they were crazy. Yeah. They very nearly, when Nick was playing there, they had Alfie Tuala, do you remember him?
Yeah.
And Dan Ward-Smith, and they had some really good players, and they were so close to getting promoted.
They've gone to the
Premiership. They just missed out to Bristol, I think it was.
Oh, you must have played Plymouth.
Yeah.
Yes.
played against Graham Dorr when he was about 48.
Yeah,
playing for them.
He was the coach. He was still
hard as nails.
Hard as nails. But he used to say to all of the forwards except for Dan Ward-Smith and Alfie Tuala, like, basically, you used to say to my brother, you're not allowed to pass the ball. The rule was you cannot pass the ball. It was total no risk rugby. And they used to have
so ridiculous.
And Graham Dorr was the first person I'm aware of to do the like 15 man maul. So they used to get all of the backs.
Isn't it funny?
Into the mall.
If Graham Dorr says 15 man maul, it's so regressive. But if, I don't know, I'm trying to think of...
Scotty Robertson or someone.
Oh my God, 15 man maul? Such hybrid players.
I've just found the message from Tiffany on Patreon that you're referencing.
Oh, what was the name? Sorry. It's a very long...
It's an impressively long email.
It is.
From a relatively new... rugby fan. I'll just go. She's asked some very interesting and good questions. I'll just go for the last question. This is question 7. Mm-hmm. There are several subsections to some of the questions.
It's incredibly thoughtful.
It sounds like
incredibly
sort of question
thoughtful
you
message.
Enjoy.
Yeah, it's
answering in detail in report format.
It's very good, but I'll go for this. Just question 7. Why aren't Americans better at rugby union? I watched the World Cup.
That's a great
question. And we live close to the USA Naval Academy. And I watched them play Trinity College last year. We Americans seem to be good enough to be invited to play, but that's about it. What is the answer?
What is the answer?
Well, Sevens, they are one of the best teams in the world.
I think it's a perspective thing, this. Right, so if you're viewing America as not being very good at rugby compared to New Zealand, you are right, they're not very good.
350 million versus 3 million population.
Yeah. But if you look at America versus the rest of the world, then what, they're in the top 20?
They're definitely in the top 20, maybe top 15.
I mean, it's a good rugby-playing nation, and it's got a lot of talent and a lot of athletic talent. The everlasting question about America is how do they access that talent, make them want to play? How do they get... I hate this word so much. I'm so sick of this word. How do they get a pathway into the national team? The answer is that you do it by creating clubs that people want to go to, like the ones that we've visited at Bayonne or Morris or whoever it may be. That's how you do it. So I think they're quite a good nation, actually. I just think it's perspective.
Yeah, there's a lot of focus on the transition from NFL players. Like you say, they're a country with incredible raw athletic talent, and the transition from, say, NFL or basketball or whatever it is to rugby, problem being that isn't going to be a solution ultimately. That will get you huge men, but it will not get you... It's like rugby union players like trying to become NFL players. It's very, very rare.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it?
It's unbelievably difficult because growing up and the nuances and reading the game and all of that is... If you don't get that nailed when you're young... It's very rare for a player to not play any rugby and be really good when they're older.
Yeah, not play any. You can think of some good examples of lads that have played basketball, particularly. I'm thinking of Jerome Tion, I think, was a basketball player before.
I went to uni with Joe Alabd. He didn't play rugby before university.
Really?
Yeah. Mm.
So Courtney Laws was he about 30 when he first started playing, but didn't play properly until he was 17?
He played on the wing.
Did he?
Yeah.
Wow.
terrifying. Yeah, there are a few lads that haven't... who play fairly late. American footballers can play relatively late on as well. Basketball seems to be the place you get these guys from because of the multi-directional movements and whatnot. As for props, I mean, why they're not getting heavyweight wrestlers to be props? Terrifying individuals. That's
your dream is to go full fox catcher.
Full fox catcher. Just go, stable
of
props.
Yeah, stable of props.
Go, and they all live in a dormitory.
Yeah. It's got super fast Wi-Fi.
Yeah. On my land, it's stable of props, which I go and visit every morning. I feed hay, that kind of stuff.
But yeah, it's the Sevens, because it's less specialised, every player has to be able to do a bit of everything. And in Sevens, the super, super talented and really super quick individuals will just stand out. And Perry Baker and Carlin Isles are the best players in the world to watch at Sevens because they make unbelievable athletes look like cart horses.
Yeah. Yeah.
So I think the reason New Zealand appears to overperform is that in a country with a population of, what, 3 or 4 million, it's the number one sport. They all play it from a very young age. It's through the school system. There's a well-established club system. And that that coaching at young ages is actually why New Zealand do so well.
Yeah, this is cultural there, isn't it? Yeah. It's, you know, same as American football. It's cultural in Texas or wherever.
Yeah, and basketball in America. Yeah.
So I think until you get into... until you get into schools, or like you say, you have a network of local clubs that people want to go along to at a young age, like you've got the archetypal soccer mum right now in America, that will probably bear fruit, you'd think, in years to come.
So just one thing which America can... I mean, say there's a lack of skills in America, and there is because of the coaching. They do happen to have the world's best fly half. So you can build your team around that, can't you?
Not strictly speaking an American, however...
Yeah, he came through the American schooling system, I think.
If he says he's American, he's American.
As American as apple pie. Exactly. He definitely sounds American.
Yes, he is. He's very American.
He's got an all-American look.
He has.
He does.
He's got an all-American wife. He's got a half-American child now, so, well, no, we've got a full-American
child.
Full-American child. so there we go. Carl Brewster. Have you spoken about Carl Brewster?
What does Carl Brewster ask?
He says, "Hi, guys.
Hi.
Hi.
Quick question for the pod on the Q&A pod." Okay. "You had previously said that you don't want rugby to turn into football, with the constant sacking of coaches, etc., which I do agree with. However, when is it acceptable for questions about the coach's position to be asked?"
Oh, it depends. It depends. Because I'll give you an example. I'm very much in the mould of... if you've made the right appointment, you need to trust them and give them time. There is a reason why you appointed them, and therefore they should be given due time. However, sometimes you make the wrong appointment. For example, see a number of Leicester's recent appointment in coaches, pretty much every one over the last 5 years, right up to Steve Borthwick. And I almost never would have made any of them, really, in the first instance. And so I would always be wanting a faster decision. But the board, there must have been a reason why they appointed Matt O'Connor again, and Major I quite like, but Jordan Murphy. So in those instances, it felt too late to get them out because they never should have been appointed in the first place.
I've seen a lot of this in... I've seen this in companies I've got friends that have worked in, or may have worked in before myself, but where bosses get rid of someone below them because actually they're just saving their own bacon and they're the ones that's incompetent. And I think potentially with Leicester Tigers, there's an argument there. The common denominator there was that the wrong appointment was made multiple times and the people that were above were the ones that probably needed to have a little word with themselves or be gone.
So rugby's got a small problem here, which is, the problem is which coach? Because football is very clear, isn't it? You have a first-team head coach.
Well, yeah, you have the one focal point, don't you?
Yeah.
Who might not necessarily do that much coaching. For example, I don't think Jose Mourinho, for example, does very much coaching, but the book stops with him in terms of the performance. Whereas rugby, because of the specialisation of the coaches and there's a lot more prominent coaches, they can get blamed. Like if you've got a scrum coach and your scrum is massively underperforming, that's where the focus will be.
Yeah, and well, yes, there's that. And also, in football, the coach comes on and gives an interview. You never see the director of football coming on and giving an interview. And you wonder, like, well, who is the one who is in charge here? Is it your head coach? Paul Gustard wasn't a head coach or a director of rugby. You know what he was?
He wasn't a finisher. He wasn't a...
game changer.
He wasn't game changer.
He wasn't a game changer. He wasn't... an Apache helicopter.
No.
What was he?
He was head of rugby. So that's not a head coach, and it's not a director of rugby.
Yeah.
So then you've got a situation like Gloucester, who had a director of rugby,
David Humphreys was director of rugby.
Yep.
Ackerman,
who was a head coach who didn't do much coaching, and then the coaching team.
Yeah.
That's quite convoluted. So who gets the chop? David Humphreys has never come on for interview. Well, he would. But then if the team did poorly, would you say David Humphreys is at fault or is Ackerman at fault? Yeah, and that's what I don't like, really. I don't like...
I don't like that way of thinking. And I used the phrase the other week, the footballification of rugby. Sometimes you can have, like, a couple of bad apples in the playing squad that... sours everything, and just having this sudden focus that it's all on the head coach / director of rugby, and if a team's playing bad, they need to go, is an oversimplification of something that's multifactorial.
Mm. So there is a difference here, Tim. And the difference is, in football, you can have bad apples because... Let me think of an example now of... It happened in rugby. Someone said something about this in rugby the other day, or did they? Okay, this is basically what I'm saying. In football, look at how the money is distributed between all of the staff, including the players and staff. You might have a manager in there who you pay 5 million quid to, but then you have two players in there who you pay 40 million quid to each. So what do you do? Well, and same with quarterbacks in the NFL. You pay the quarterback 100 million a year, and you pay the coach, I don't know, 5 million per year or whatever it is. Do you listen to the coach who says this quarterback's a bad apple, or do you fire the coach? Now, rugby, I think we're more balanced because you've got a salary cap, and that salary cap, because it's fairly modest, is pushing up coaching pay massively. And therefore, you are inclined to give your coach a little bit more time because that's where your money is now. And I think that's a big difference between football and rugby, which is why you see football managers just chucked out because... The money stays.
But to the broader point, a team playing well or not playing well is a multi-factor equation.
Mm, absolutely.
I think it's always the easiest thing to do, and it's what we crave, a simple, easy answer. And just to say, coach, get rid.
Yeah.
Is I think, just oversimplifying. And actually... And that's why I have a lot of sympathy for... allowing people to bed thinking, because I would say on Leicester Tigers, what Steve Borthwick has done brilliantly, and actually this is to his credit and maybe why he's the right man for the job at the top there, is he has...
He's not director of rugby.
He's head coach.
He has had a proper clear out. Yeah. He has got rid of the deadwood.
But they got rid of the deadwood last year and the year before that.
Not to this extent.
Oh, check out the numbers. It was brutal.
No, I know, but now they have the squad they wanted, but this has been a five-year process to get from where they were when they overpaid, kept hold of players they shouldn't have kept hold of, had the value in the wrong places.
But... I wouldn't be surprised if it's COVID. It's really helped out Leicester Tigers. And they got rid of all those players in one go.
Got rid of five players.
Yeah, got rid of lots of highly paid players. What's his name then went? Tolofua?
Tulisivianu. Tolofua went.
Tolofua went because he decided he didn't want to stay there anymore. Off you go.
Eastman went. Manu went.
Tolofua's a shame, actually. If they could have persuaded him.
Tolofua.
Jordan
Tolofua.
Tolofua. Jordan Tolofua.
Yeah. So... Have I told you about my three categories of directors of rugby?
I can't remember.
So I've started to divide up the directors of rugby into three categories now. So
okay,
because I'm kind of getting to the point that I think we should fire them all.
Is it
just fire them all?
Suit, tracksuit,
not follow wrong. So category number one, right, of guys who when they walk away, the team improves. See, Paul Gustard. Even though he wasn't director of rugby, you know what I'm saying, right? Gustard would be one. I hate to say it, but Malander probably, when he walked, would be another. But Malander could come into a second
and category. He won the premiership.
Yeah, so he might come.
Hold on. Did they win the premiership?
Yeah.
Did he win the premiership?
Did he win the premiership?
No, did he win the premiership?
Didn't they get to the final?
They got to the final. I'm trying to remember.
Because they got to a final when Dylan Hartley called.
No, they did. They definitely did win.
Yeah, they did.
They won about 2013.
Yeah, they did.
Right, so actually, I'm going to put Malander into category number two, right? So category number one is the guy who... Their team is better when they walk.
Yeah.
Okay, so he should go, obviously.
Yes.
Category number two is the guy who is intrinsic to everything that the club does.
Rob Baxter.
Steve Diamond. Malander would be that. Well, how do they go? They eventually get worn out. Whether it be Diamond or Malander or whoever it is, eventually they get to the end of their shelf life because they've just bloody worked so hard. And then there's the third category, who is the guy who does such a good job, he's no longer needed.
He brings up the best coaches.
Yep. Gary Gold.
Gets an amazing coaching team around them.
Yeah, exactly. Does himself out of a job. All three of those people technically should really be able to be removed. And not only that, the director of rugby position now is getting so ridiculous. Because, we need an overseer. We need a guy, the emperor of rugby, who everyone can lean on to be a consultant and knows everything. And they're paying the most. And he usually does the least. So, is your coaches out there training people?
But that's to misunderstand. It's not effort and time. And you see this when you see corporate structures. As you go further up the leadership pyramid, you do less work in real terms.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
But the decisions you make are far more consequential holistically and affect everybody. And so they're way more important. And it takes a lot of experience, knowledge, and consideration to make those key decisions.
I think those individuals are so vanishingly rare that paying 400K to... or 300K or whatever it is to the England defence coach to be that guy is not really... Here's an idea. Do you remember when Leinster were going... They started with Leo Cullen and he wasn't doing so well. They didn't get a director of rugby. They did something else. Do you remember? They got Graham Henry as a consultant over the phone. That is infinitely cheaper and probably better. If you want someone just as a sounding board, get someone on the phone.
On the Paul Gustard thing, hindsight is 20/20, because I don't remember anybody, you included, saying it was a bad call. Everyone was roundly saying what a fantastic signing that is. Brilliant.
Yeah, he'll toughen up Quinns.
A change of the from the old ways to the new ways. Yeah, I remember saying all that as well. And... Yeah. It was evidently
which
wrong.
Which is why I think directors of rugby, if you were smart, you would get... Like, Steve Diamond's on around now. Maybe he doesn't want a full-time job. I'd happily pay him a day rate, though. Like, you know, if you genuinely want someone as a sounding board, give him a call. He'll happily take 700 quid a day.
One of the problems, I think, is... And we've kind of touched on it now, but it's the confusion between the head coach role, the... whatever Gustard was, head of rugby or head of sport, and the director of rugby. Because in football, Jay, you highlighted it before, you have the kind of first team coach, which is the Jurgen Klopp, the Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, and then less so OGS, the Mourinho, the Arteta, the Pep Guardiola type. Above them, you have a director of football or sporting director who usually, unless you're a real football club geek, you've never even heard of these individuals. A lot of them aren't necessarily even former players. They are accountants, lawyers, businessmen who are in that position. And rugby seems to have like confused the two roles.
Yep.
And there should be a very defined... It's effectively the head of the activities on the pitch and then the head of the activities off the pitch, which would be the sporting director or director of rugby.
I think someone who I personally think is very good at the off-the-field stuff, and stays off the field, but is in charge of everything, is someone like Steve Vaughan at Wasps. Like, he does of that stuff off the field, and then you go directly into the rugby staff. And I don't think Blackett's a director of rugby, is he?
He's head coach.
I think he's head coach.
That, to me, sounds ideal.
Yeah, so that, you have a businessman doing the off-field stuff, and a rugby coach doing the on-field stuff, and keep the boundary between them quite clear. Now, there are exceptions to that. Someone like Steve Diamond, who has... in the past had a foot in both camps, and probably Baxter as well, a foot in both camps, but that needs to be a really special individual. And just, for example, just promoting, I feel like I'm having a real go at Jordan Murphy here, but just promoting Jordan Murphy to director of rugby with no seeming basis based on his on-field performance or his off-field experience just seems ludicrous.
Yeah, it does. It really does make me wonder what a lot of directors of rugby do. And I know they'll tell everyone will say, you know, like, what does Joe Hooper do?
What did David Humphreys do?
But if you look at just purely in terms of hours and minutes, and, you know, someone standing behind watching as loads of coaches go and do the coaching, if you just look at it in those terms, then yes. But just to return to what you said, and to pick up on Paul Gustard, and compare that to, say, Rob Baxter, which I think that's the archetypal setup, because It's whilst being very clearly defined, it's clearly very fluid as well. To the point that Exeter have little periods in a season, a couple of weeks, where they will change roles and they'll do each other's jobs. Just to keep it fresh.
Interesting.
Yeah. That's interesting.
I mean, look, Rob Baxter is like a generational.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. Yeah. But what I was going to say was, arguably, you could look at Paul Gustard through a different lens. Like, he's gone and they've done better, and so it's all worked out for the best for Harlequins. But arguably, maybe he needed more autonomy, and he needed to have the ability to be more like Steve Diamond or Rob Baxter, so that everyone else went, no, he is absolutely the boss. What he says goes. And maybe, I'm not saying this is the case at Quins, but maybe it was the case that when you're not quite top man, top perch, what you say goes, and you have total power... people, like the cracks can form with some people. Yeah.
One of the big weaknesses of everything that I think is actually Leicester Tigers and their old structure, because I think their old structure is really good. It turns
Cockers.
Out. No, yes, kind of. So you had Cockers doing the rugby, but the de facto director of rugby would be
Jed
and Mason, Simon, because they've got agency backgrounds. I thought that was going to work really well. And also, they've got a little subdivision, haven't they, of the rugby committee, which is a quad of Ben Kay and the three others.
Not Rory Underwood.
It is Rory Underwood. Mm. Yeah, yeah, it is. Maybe it's Jed. And it was Jed, Mason, and
Simon Cohen. Anyway, yeah.
Doesn't really matter. Although the structure made sense, it didn't actually work.
Yeah.
And they didn't have a director of rugby, quite kind of like that.
That's what I mean. Sometimes rugby by committee doesn't work.
But then Lyon, in the French, not top 14, the football club, do run on committee. Like, they literally, they have loads of coaches changing over. And I don't know if they still do it now, but it's actually referenced in, like, Soconomics, which they have lots of people on a board, and that will be it. It's like the wisdom of the crowd. And I think there's something to that. For Leicester, their revival has been based around another guy from an agency background who's come in to put systems and processes in, who will then hand over that to the new team manager that is coming on board. So it is a very similar kind of process as they had before, but this time it's working. So maybe they just had
maybe it's just individuals.
As long as all of the different roles and people are pulling towards a unified point, then it works. It doesn't really matter what the structure is, really, as long as that is the outcome.
And there's also team managers who seem to be working on the team side, doing all of the admin for all the off-the-field stuff, but they aren't responsible for performance, so like arranging coach trips and whatnot. So like Quinn's now will be relying more on Billy Millard, for instance, or you know, whoever, or Dave Bassett at Wasps, or whoever that is. They have an enormous role too. So when you think, oh, well, maybe the director of rugby is organising everything, well, that's usually the team manager. What are directors of rugby doing? Fire them all.
But you'd say, if you were going to say that, you'd say that about every managing director, or because
he's actually top of the
tree, director
right?
of rugby would be a chief exec. You'd say that about every chief exec at every corporate, every company in the land.
They are actual. The actual chief.
Director
of rugby is a director's position.
But what does the chief executive do, ultimately, when you bubble what that role is? What do they do?
Well, chief executive stuff, they're just decision makers, aren't they? They're high level decision makers.
They're high level, high level decision makers, high level course plotters.
I guess the word director, they direct where the organisation's going. That's why I think director of rugby is just a nonsense.
The confusion between the rules and the inconsistency in the rule is terrible. Mm. One more question.
So we do a lot we do some chats for people that are doing economics courses. This one would be like business and management. segment.
Did we answer the question? When do we fire managers?
ASAP.
Yeah, as soon as they lose a game.
Yeah.
Yes, one game and they're gone.
One game gone.
Agreed.
Right, last question, because this leads into the final bit. Oh. This is from Rich Mason, who says, "Gents, love the pod, blah, blah, blah. Yeah. Can you make sure that you all predict clearly, one way or the other, the outcome of the Premiership games? If you do this, I will be able to share something with you at the end of the season regarding how accurate each of your predictions are over the course of a season."
Uh-oh.
Which is terrifying.
Perhaps you
could create a Tetlock Cup for the best predictor.
So I just want to say about this, right? The way that I predict rugby games is not necessarily what I think the most likely outcome is. The way I predict rugby games is, where will I get the most praise if this happens to come off?
Which is why you often predict both teams to win.
Yeah, exactly right. Well, you know, I like to say things like, of course Worcester will beat Exeter. Of course they will. Then I've seen it. So it's a bigger payoff for me. I'm not interested in these small wins.
Okay. Speaking of small wins, Friday 16th of April, we have Northampton Saints at home to London Irish.
Tasty game.
Both had disappointment in Europe.
I think London Irish do them. I think they are more physical. Although Albert Tuasui dropped the ball an awful lot, he is a bloody good ball carrier.
He's a very good ball carrier.
Saints do struggle with that. Saints are young and talented and explosive, but you need more than that.
I can't believe that Dan Bigger will be vetoing the Rugby Dungeon podcast now after that. I'm going to go Northampton at home. I'm almost ready to say I'm a London Irish fan now.
Almost there.
I'm very close to it.
Have we got a London Irish shirt?
No, we don't.
I've got. I can lay my hands on them.
Got loads.
I know. I've got loads knocking
he's
about.
He's got loads at home.
Give me Saints. Give me Northampton at home. Then we have Exeter Chiefs against Wasps Saturday at 12:30 kickoff.
Yeah, it's an early kickoff now because the games that were on BT Sport were going to be one after the other because of the funeral of Prince Philip, the Duke of Edinburgh. Yeah. It's been split one before, one after.
Yeah.
Did we talk about Prince Philip yesterday?
No.
Did we not? Do you know he fought at the Battle of Cape Matapan?
I did not.
Cape Matapan. Go and have a look at the Battle of Cape Matapan.
Is that the one in? Is that in the Indian Ocean or in the Mediterranean?
It's in the Med. Yeah. I think he served on HMS Valiant.
Yeah, because I know he served in those two parts of World War II.
Oh, yes, of course. He was there for the surrender of Japan.
Yeah.
What a life.
Yeah.
What a life.
Unbelievable life.
Look at the Battle of Cape Matapan. What a story. What a great job the Royal Navy did. It's just a great, great story. And he was on the searchlights. And that doesn't mean anything to you right now. But if you look at that story and find out what they were doing with those searchlights...
Because he was
together.
Of noble birth, like Danish and Greek, wasn't it?
Something like that, yeah.
So I'm going, really? Was he really put in danger?
Like, oh, yeah. Genuine danger. Like, wow. In the Falklands, was it Prince Andrew that flew Harriers? Like, legitimate... Lee flew Harriers.
Yeah, well, the Falklands, I've seen someone explain the Falklands War as, you know, when you've got a big guy and a really short guy, and the big guy's holding the little guy by the head with a straight arm, and the little guy's swinging his arms trying to hit but can't reach.
Yeah.
Because the UK just had bombs that went further than the Argentinian bombs.
I take issue with that on the count of, like, we were fighting on their doorstep and we had to get all the stuff there.
Yeah, of course.
But, yes, I can see why you'd think that a great military power like ourselves back in the day would have a bit of a mismatch there. It's actually very, very hard to do that.
Logistically, as much as anything. Because I'd heard them say he served in the Royal Navy, in the Indian Ocean, and in the Mediterranean during World War II. And I thought, wow, fair play.
He properly served.
But there you go. That was the bit I was going, was it? Was it like...
Find out what they did to the Polar, the Zara, and the other Italian cruiser, which they happened to encounter in the Med that night. And then you'll realise it was a big deal.
There's one awesome little naval story. So I go to the Peloponnese in Greece quite a lot. And there's one little place called Pylos. And the Bay of Pylos, there was the Turkish Navy and the British Navy was defending Greece, and one of the Turkish Navy accidentally fired something, and then the British boats just sunk the whole Turkish Navy on the, and as a result there are statues of British soldiers in this part of Greece.
I think they fly
a Union Jack there for that reason, and there are still Turkish boats
incredible
on the floor. Some amazing stories, isn't there?
The escapades of the Royal Navy.
And we
not...
think we've got it tough.
Yeah.
We think we've got it tough at the minute.
The escapades of the Royal Navy, whilst not always wholesome, are usually very, very fun to read.
I think I might have mentioned it before, just one more quick one. The story of the naval soldiers that were on a passenger ferry trying to flee Hong Kong or Japan, was it? Or it might have been Hong Kong. Trying to flee Hong Kong. They were doing it in a commercial ship and to get away. And it got sunk. It got hit. Or it might have been an actual naval ship. I don't know. But the basic story is that there were loads of British naval soldiers in a boat that got sunk. The doors were locked, so they were stuck. They couldn't get out, and the couple of people that did manage to get out, and the other people that were in the area, said what they heard from the boat as it went down with these British soldiers locked in this little bit was them singing.
Oh God! Enough of that.
Singing naval songs.
Oh
wow!
So the stoicism of these men.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Far younger than we are now is amazing. I find it amazing.
Better people than I. Yeah, yeah. That's a fact.
Yeah, I'll find out the name of that story because I think you'd like that.
Yeah, it's just made it's grisly. What were they saying?
Chiefs Wasps.
Chiefs Wasps.
Oh yeah.
Oh yeah. That.
We've got to do some predictions.
The Chiefs.
Chiefs.
5-0.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Or maybe 5-1. No, 5-0.
Yes. Wasps have had a week off. Exeter had a tough game last weekend, but Exeter will correct that.
And now they've got one singular focus.
Correct. Yes. Sale host Gloucester as well.
Will I go to this game? Yes, I probably will, if I'm allowed.
Sale home win.
Sale home win.
Definitely.
Yeah.
Quinns host Worcester.
Quinns.
Big Quinns win.
Quinns home win.
Yeah.
So we've gone for four home wins so far, Phil.
Yeah. Newcastle versus Bristol.
Yeah.
Will be an away win, I think.
That will be an away win.
Will it be an away win? Will it, though?
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah, on balance, probably. This is a tasty one. Here we go.
The final game of the weekend on Sunday at 3 o'clock is Bath hosting Leicester.
Woohoo! Yeah.
Every bone in my body wants to say Leicester. It's willing Leicester to win. Willing Leicester to win. Let's bring this area of Bath to an end now. Right? It's a failed experiment. That said, it's not failed, is it? Because I think Bath will really do well against Leicester's style of play. I'm not sure Leicester going and playing like Leicester is going to do particularly well against Bath. This worries me.
It's two packs that want to go for it,
yeah.
And there's a sprinkling of talent outside them.
Yeah,
probably a bit more of a sprinkling on the Bath side, but so I think this will be a great game. This will be very physical.
We have to balance up, weigh up two things here in my mind. One, Bath's back talent versus Leicester's tactical nous, basically the way that they
basically
played the game.
Wigglesworth and George Ford.
Yeah. Now I think you've just said Wigglesworth and George Ford. Give me Leicester.
Well, it'll probably be Ben Youngs and George Ford.
Nah.
Give me Bath.
No, Ben Youngs is third choice Leicester scrum half.
Yeah, it'd be interesting to see who they pick. There's no way I would not pick the way they're playing.
Wiggy. Give me Wiggy.
Yeah. I pick Wigglesworth for almost every team.
I think this is a great game.
I think it will be.
And I'm going to go for Bath. Just.
If Leicester can pin them in the corners and then make them pay, that's a big if, isn't it?
It's a big if. I think Leicester. I think Bath. I've said this times.
Is Priestland fit?
Don't know.
Don't know.
Bailey had a head injury, didn't he?
Yeah.
Bailey went off.
So he's not.
If Priestland's not fit, it's Leicester.
Yeah.
I don't think Priestland gives them what they need. I think Priestland's got some nice hands on occasion. I don't think he's tactically astute.
No. Bath, I've said this before, but they either score their tries through total physicality or individual brilliance. And I think they'll struggle against Leicester with that kind of
shout. I'm going to change my mind.
Up.
I'm going Leicester away.
Yeah, give me Leicester.
Leicester, yeah.
Four home wins and then Bristol and Leicester away.
I think Irish will win. I think Irish will beat North Saints.
I could see that.
I can see it. Maybe not this week.
What would that do? Let me have a look on my Bath tracker. See what that would do. It would make no difference really to the table, other than separating Leicester from Leicester from Bath a bit more.
All the teams below Bath are losing this week.
It might make it six teams only. It might cement the top six.
Yeah, Leicester will get into the top six, and then we'll start applying pressure to Harlequins as I expected.
I think they're going
to Leicester lose, and then I know nothing about rugby. Who knows?
At least we've been clear about our predictions this time. And with that, we'll end this podcast. Thank you very much for watching. I did see some more messages on the live chat. Steve Parrott, I saw your little message about my brother getting knocked out and your video evidence of it. I'd love to see that.
Oh, yes.
Oh, did he?
I'd love to see that.
Wow.
Yeah, yeah. Please let me see that, because he might need it as an exhibit for the
the court case.
The court case. And yeah, thank you very much. And yes, David Price was backing you up on Prince Andrew flew Sea King helicopters, not Harriers.
Oh, is that what he flew?
So there you go.
Idiot me.
Yeah, that's all right. Good. Thank you very much. That was our leadership and historical naval conquest podcast done for another day. You can find us on patreon.com/eggchasers, on Twitter, and make sure you hit subscribe in the feed on YouTube as well, because Dan Bigger will be popping up in about 24 hours' time. In the meantime,
about an hour.
Let the boys play.
Let the boys play.
Tired of ads intruding into your favorite comedy podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Dive into a world of laughs by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/comedyadfree. That's amazon.com/comedyadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.
So, you've got an idea for a business. The store of your dreams. There's just one thing to figure out. Everything. That's why Shopify's all-in-one commerce platform makes it easy to sell online, in person, and everywhere else. Sell on social media, source products with an app to get that first sale feeling. It's the only solution that gives you everything you need to sell everywhere you want. So when you're ready to bring your idea to life, power it up with Shopify.
Sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/listen.